My name is Chris Lam, and with my advisor and co-author, we did a study looking at parent expectations and how these expectations affect children's marijuana use, initiation resistance over time. And I'll get into that in a minute. So sort of a brief introduction to what we looked at and what motivated us to do this research is we looked at lifetime marijuana use in 2012 of a nationwide U.S. sample of adolescents, and what you see is marijuana use by the time you're about a senior in high school goes up to almost half. And so it seems as though eighth grade you have, you know, a bump, and then by the time you're in 10th grade or 12th grade you have a much significantly larger bump of marijuana use in high schools. And this is a giant nationally representative sample. And so we believe that, according to additional research, that it's important to factor in that drug prevention involves consistent features of most adolescents' family environments and their interactions with their parents. So the predominant focus of our research was looking at the parent-child relationship. So what is it about the interactions and the expectations between the parents and their children, and how does that end up shaping marijuana use behavior? And so our sort of theoretical position, we're social psychologists by trade, was looking at the self-fulfilling prophecy. So to what extent does the relationship between two people thinking about a particular behavior or regarding a particular behavior, does that influence each other? And so Merton, back in the late 40s, to sort of put forth the self-fulfilling prophecy as this erroneous belief that the expectation ultimately leads to the fulfillment of the behavior. So if you think a child is going to do really great in school, chances are they're going to do really great in school. So there's a lot of work that I believe is Rosenthal did, I think it was like in the 80s, where they randomized students into and told the teachers, oh, this is a really bright student and this is not. And then they looked at about a year or so down the line and the randomly assigned students who were considered bright ended up doing really good because teachers ended up treating them differently. And there's more to it than that, but that's just giving you an idea of one way it can be applied. So we were sort of looking at how can we end up using the self-fulfilling prophecy idea and sort of explore drug use behaviors between parents and their children. And Jessam believes that if only these sort of erroneous expectations can be established as self-fulfilling. So if you're correct in presuming your child is a drug user, if you're correct in the child is being bright and doing well in education, that really doesn't factor into the self-fulfilling prophecy or these expectancy issues. And so upon extrapolating from the self-fulfilling prophecy literature, you see in the bottom two bullets, we believe that parents who mistakenly assume their children use drugs, in this case marijuana, may inadvertently promote the problem they're seeking to avert. So you have parents who think that their kid is a user and the kid is not a user. We believe that over time they're going to end up pushing the kids into using. This also suggests the opposite, where it is possible that parents who mistakenly believe that their kids are not using when the kid actually is using, we believe that will end up influencing their future drug use behavior. And so, specifically, studies concerned with these inconsistencies between parent estimates and what the child is actually doing. So is a child a marijuana user or not? And does the parent think the child is a user or not? And then we're looking at child subsequent use 1 year later. So this is time one to time two. So this is a general way of thinking about it. So you have a child who says, I am a marijuana user. Child says, I'm not a marijuana user. The parent says, my child is. The parent says, my child isn't. And so we're more interested in the red mismatch cells than we are in the green cells, because the red mismatch cells, that's where you see the parent expectancies of self-fulfilling prophecy is going to actually push in either direction. And so depending on the inconsistency, we think that these discrepancies between parents' beliefs and children's behavior could have either detrimental or beneficial outcomes. And so our hypotheses are, at time two, the youth admitting to using in the prior year are expected to be more frequent users. And the hypothesis two is children of parents who believe they had used in the past year also are expected to exhibit greater frequency of marijuana use. And our second analysis, we're looking at the misdiagnosis. So we want to determine if discrepancies between these parent beliefs and the children's self-reports at time one were linked to frequency of marijuana use at time two. So the method of the study, we're using the National Survey of Parents and Youth. It's a gigantic study where the U.S. government ended up getting parents and their kids over, I think it was like four years, and asked them a bunch of questions and exposed them to drug campaigns and asked them about drug use behaviors and parental warmth and a plethora of stuff. And it's a gigantic survey. Our lab has sort of looked at this in great detail, and this is one of the more, I think, interesting studies, because I'm interested in the connection between parents and youth. So we're using this and drawing from a restricted data set of the National Survey of Parents and Youth. And there's more about the instrument and procedures. If you want to learn more about that, we can get you that information. You could look up an article that we've done in 2008. Or look into the stuff from the National Institute of Drug Abuse in 2006. It's very super lengthy and it's pretty intense. So we used 3,100 adults and their kids, and using data from the first 2 years of a four-year panel survey of this gigantic study, and the data from the adolescents range from 12 to 17. And the reason why we stopped at 17 is a year later they'd be 18 and then they would end up aging out of the survey. And any of the youth who were under 12 got a different type of survey. So we have about a 5 to 6 year spread, and as you can see in the bottom is a sort of general demographics of what the sort of sample looks like. So we have an average age of about 14, and I believe they ended up sampling a little bit more on the younger end. Then at the older end, the parents ended up being around 42 years old. It was about split between males and females. The majority of the sample was white, but it was weighted to be nationally representative. So this is just a general breakdown of what the sample actually looks like. And so the measures, so one of the first questions we're interested at is asking the adolescents, have you ever even once used marijuana during the last 12 months? And so they were basically asked to respond yes or no. And this served as the study's operational definition of whether the child was a user or the child was not a user. The parents were asked a different type of question, which we ended up breaking down to the same sort of dichotomy. So how many times, if any, do you think that your child has used marijuana in the last 12 months? And so they gave a frequency. So if they said, no, my child hasn't used in the last 12 months, then they were put in one category. And if they said anything else, they were put into another. So we dichotomized it so like zeros and ones or yeses and nos. And you can see the actual question. And at time two, we were interested in the frequency of marijuana use. And so we're looking at more of a range of the question. So the question was approximately 1 year after the first measurement, the youth were asked, how long has it been since you last smoked? And so we were interested in seeing how the frequency changes between year one and year two. So in the first year, we could see we basically had it broken down. It was like you're a user or you're not a user. And the parents say you were a user or you were not a user. And then at time two, we looked at the frequency of the use for everybody in the different categories. And so the respondents were reported not having used marijuana. They received a score of zero, so they were still considered a non-user. And if they responded otherwise, they were broken down into one of these six categories in regards to frequency of use. For those of you interested in what the control variables were, we controlled for the sex of the respondents, the parents and the youths, age of the child, their evaluations of friends' delinquency level, and these are all things that come out in research that are related to marijuana use. We want to make sure we had a very clear signal. We also controlled for youth self-report of delinquency behaviors, their alcohol use, and their estimate of their parent knowledge of their illicit substance use. And so our first analysis, we did a 2x2 ANCOBA. We were looking at parents' belief the child's a user or not a user, and then the kids report, you know, I am a user or I am not a user. And the dependency measure, we're looking at frequency of use at time two. So after a year, looking at their marijuana use. The data were weighted, as I mentioned before, to be nationally representative. And so this is an estimate of what the sample of U.S. 12 to 17-year-old youth would look like, from statistically speaking. So of the covariates that we ended up looking at, older adolescents tended to report higher levels of marijuana use at time two, which is also reflected in research. And you can see in 8th grade and 10th grade and 12th grade, the marijuana use tended to go up, so we controlled for that. Youth tended to report higher levels of delinquency and alcohol use at time one, also reported greater marijuana use. And peer delinquency, sex of parent, child of the sex of child covariates were not statistically significant, so those didn't really factor in as covariates. So the analysis disclosed two statistically significant main effects. So in confirmation of our first hypothesis, the youth reporting marijuana use at time one reported significantly more frequent use at time two than time one abstinent use. So users ended up using more at time two than non-users, which, you know, makes sense. The second point, kids of parents who expressed a belief that their child had used marijuana at time one reported more frequent use than of marijuana use at time two than youth whose parents believe their children had not been using. So you have parents who believe their kids are users. Those kids tended to be using more at time two than the kids who than the parents who believe their kids didn't use, which also makes sense. So the most interesting thing is we're interested in the interaction. So that's sort of the off-diagonal cells. And so the interaction of these two predictions was statistically significant, and the resulting pattern supported our third hypothesis. And if you want to sort of read through that, that's fine. I can give you a graphic in a minute, which will make it a lot easier. So time one, self-reported non-users whose parents expressed the belief that their child had used. So these are non-users whose parents think that they are using. Use drugs significantly more frequently at time two when you compare to those who assume that they had not used. So that's one of the cells. And then self-reported users at time one whose parents believe that they had used marijuana were more frequent marijuana users at time two than those whose parents mistakenly believe they were abstinent at time one. So this is non-users to use. So we end up having is time one and time two, and the blue dashed line are the parents who say no. The parents who say yes are going to be on the red line. And so we end up seeing from time one to time two, if your parent says no, you have a small increase in use. But if you're a non-user and your parent says yes, then you have a much larger spike, right? So there's something going on here where the parents are, where the parents say, you know, I think my kid is using, and these are non-using children. So there's something, and this is a statistically significant difference. And so there's something going on that is influencing the kids and their marijuana use, and we're really interested in what that might be. And we believe that parent expectancies and the self-fulfilling prophecy is part of that. So what you kind of have here, when you look at it, is there's something about parents thinking that their kids are users that might be pushing them in the direction of actually using, which is what they don't want their kids to end up doing, right? And so another thing we were interested in looking at is looking at users to reduce use. So we have a similar type of graphic, but we're going to be starting at the top. And so what you have at first are, this is just, you know, parents who said that their kids end up using. And over time, the kids tend not to use, you know, as much necessarily, but you see, like, you know, it's a change from 100% to a little bit above 80%, right? And so there we have the parents of users who say that they're not using, and we have a much more dramatic dip in what's going on. And so this is another way of looking at parent expectancies and self-fulfilling prophecies are able to push kids in the direction of non-use. And so we're really interested in what's going on there. Like, what is it that is interesting to us, and how can we use that either at a media level or to inform public health policy or whatever. And so, like, the sort of power of these self-fulfilling prophecies or the power of these different expectancies actually can push kids in either direction. and we're really interested in learning about that. And so, that was my timer. I want to make sure I don't cut into the next person. So broadly, we're looking at how the self-fulfilling prophecy can inform what's going on in this relationship, and we think this is really a powerful thing. And the results of this inform the general hypothesis. This provides a more limited and perhaps precise view of the link between parents' expectancies and the children's marijuana use. So the expected effects show that this incongruity between parents' views and children's reports was associated with either an accentuation or an attenuation of marijuana use frequency, depending on the nature of the expectation. So parents ended up thinking that their kids are going to use. They tended to push them more in the direction of use if the kid was not a user. And on the flip side, if you have parents who think that the kid is not using and the kid is a user, then that pushes them to using less. And so we think this is really powerful information, and we're actually in the sort of formative stages of looking at, well, what are some additional things that we could end up using or looking at to sort of describe what's going on here? Are there specific characteristics of the parents, specific characteristics of the kids, and, you know, how can we end up sort of moving beyond this information to get more of an idea of what might be happening here? So additional implications. The results show important implications that argue for a focus on parent behavior as a good medium through which we can foster youth drug prevention and cessation. And so the lesson that sort of emerged here is that parents can have a profound influence on their adolescents, children's drug use, and the influence can be delivered in subtle ways that parents should actually know this. My advisor, Bill Crino, was talking about sort of, you know, there's something about the power of the relationship between the parent and the child that we should actually take into consideration when it comes to delivering messages. Like, there's been some other research that's shown if you end up showing kids a message that's actually aimed at their parents, but you actually intend it to be messages, when you are actually intending it to be with the kids, it tends to be a really powerful agent of change in regards to making them think about drugs differently. Or you can deliver a message to kids when you end up forming it in a way where it's targeting their parents. So it's an intentional misdirection. And there's a bunch of attitudes literature on that. I'll stop there. I don't want to cut into anybody else's time. Yeah?
Did you have data on the drug use of the parents?
That's the next piece. And there...
That's a huge factor in setting, you know, that it has to... And the other thing that relates to that is the self-fulfilling prophecy is really sort of interesting frame to use for this, but I mean, there are other theories that could really start explaining the same correlation. I like my control theory, for example. I mean, if you're looking at, you know, bonds and social bonds, what is suggested by the nature of the social bond for a parent that says, yeah, I think my kid is using drugs. I mean, there's a lot else that could be going on there that, you know, that, I mean, I think that, so in other words, that variable, that correlation, could be reflective of, you know, a self-fulfilling prophecy process taking place, essentially a process.
Right.
But there's so many other, that's why I was curious about how those other control variables figured in, like networks and other things that obviously shape, first of all, whether or not a parent thinks their kid is using it.
Right.
Regardless of, you know, why would a parent think that? You know, there's a reason why they're thinking it.
Right, and we try to control for as many things that we believe and we found in literature that are related to that, like age and their ideas of friends and alcohol use and stuff like that. But sort of just as a reminder, this is data that's already available, so some of the stuff that you're mentioning isn't available because whoever decided to put the survey together didn't really take that into consideration, which is why we're interested in doing a second study and looking at, well, what else can we take from this data set, which is just massive, to try to inform future research? Like, are there other theoretical positions that should be taken into consideration? Because it was like, you know, a multi-million dollar, you know, project that they had done in the, you know, with the government, with NIDA. And so if we could inform future, like, maybe you should take this stuff into consideration, or how about asking these other questions, whatever, to get at some additional stuff, that would be great. However, we weren't really able to consider too much else given the restricted availability of what's present in a data set. That makes sense.
Yeah, more restrictions.
Right, I agree.